Welcome to another edition of Women of Character Barrier Busters, brought to you by the TurkNet Leadership Group. I'm Ann Quiello, a senior consultant at TurkNet and also an executive coach. We like to support leaders to figure out what their goals are and then find the right paths to achieve them. In this podcast series, I talk with women who have persevered through multiple challenges to reach the vision that they have for themselves. They've been very generous in sharing their lessons learned for others of us who may face similar challenges and are working hard to bust barriers maybe getting in the way. And today, it's my real pleasure to welcome Dr. Nicole Schmidt, and she's given me permission to call her Nikki. Nikki is a head and neck surgical oncologist and scientist. It is a mouthful. She's the co-director for translational research in the head and neck program at Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University. Her research focuses on novel therapeutic combinations for treating head and neck cancer with the goal of enhancing immune responses to cancer and long-term remission. Clinical challenges faced in a busy surgical oncology practice inspires new research that's innovative and effective for all kinds of treatment approaches, and so often pursued by Dr. Schmidt and others at the Winship Cancer Institute. So welcome, Dr. Schmidt.
Or Thank Nikki. You very much for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Well, you got to help us here. First of all, need some translation. In layman's terms, What is it that you do?
Yeah, so basically, as we kind of talked a little bit offline earlier about translational research, so what is that? It's essentially taking a question that's inspired by clinical care of patients and a challenge and turning that into a research question that we can answer in order to improve clinical care. So in other words, it's bench to bedside work. And so, you know, what'll happen is that, you know, I spend about a third of my time doing surgical treatment of head and neck cancer. So a patient that comes in with oral cancer or throat cancer is seen by us and we set them up for surgery. And that part of my job I enjoy very much. And I get attached very much to patients and their families. But sometimes we encounter challenges in terms of side effects of the treatment or ineffective treatments. That in turn leads us to go back to the laboratory where we study in cells or mice or even tumors from patients and blood samples to try to figure out what is going on, how is the immune system fighting cancer, and then ultimately we hope that what we learn in the laboratory will be used to take back to the clinic to treat our patients better with fewer side effects long term. So I really spend about a third of my time doing surgery and seeing surgical patients, a third of my time at the bench doing fundamental research, and a third of my time doing clinical trials based on things that we have found in the lab to try to see if it's a better way versus the standard of care.
What do you think is your specific expertise? What is it that you really, really have a strong expertise in that helps with the research or the surgery?
It's really about, I think what helps me and what makes it more fun is making those connections. You know, I'll notice something in the office and then I'll read a research study and some light bulb goes on and it gives me a new idea. And if I wasn't seeing the patients, I wouldn't get that idea, or I wouldn't think of it in quite the same way as somebody with a PhD who does research full time, because they're not seeing the patients, they're not seeing the challenges. So I think that as much as it feels sometimes like having three jobs, it's a lot more fun and I think in many ways more effective to be able to put all those things together. And it is challenging, but I think it makes it a lot more rewarding as well.
Well, what comes up for me as you describe it is that you have a much better opportunity to really see patients through cancer treatment and through a remedy, a solution.
Absolutely.
Yes, because you're looking for that innovative approach, whereas with any other surgeon, they may not have that same opportunity. So you bring a lot to the table, in other words. So
I hope so.
Good for you.
Yeah, and certainly my full-time surgical colleagues, they innovate surgically and they figure out how to do the surgery better. But I sort of have a more 50,000-foot view of the entire process from diagnosis. Can we diagnose it earlier? Can we treat it better? And then, you know, as I follow patients for 5 or 10 years and see the side effects of the treatment, and our survivors, that inspires me as well to look into that and see how do we find treatments that will leave them better off in 5 or 10 years in addition to in remission.
Yeah. So oftentimes when someone hears the C word, cancer, they think of it as a death sentence. Yep. In fact, it's becoming more and more of a chronic disease that's just treated on a long-term basis. Is that what you're finding?
Absolutely. In fact, the National Cancer Institute and the Biden administration really provided good data on that. We're getting better at curing cancer, and we have very ambitious goals to get even better so that we're going to have more survivors. And I think that survivorship aspect is going to become more important, as you said, as people learn to live with cancer that is waxing and waning in remission and all the side effects of the treatments we're doing to keep them alive and keep their cancer in remission. So we're getting better at curing it. And now the next challenge and hurdle is really going to be to maintain quality of life after cure.
So I just want to talk about you, Nikki. How did you decide to become a physician first, perhaps an oncology specialist, perhaps a surgeon, and then a researcher? Talk us through that evolution. How did that all happen?
Absolutely. So in school, it's very funny because I'm the first college graduate in my family, and I came from very kind of working class family, and my parents were both uninsured, self-employed artists. And so kind of growing up in that background made me appreciate access to healthcare, which in many ways we didn't have. We only went when something was very wrong because we didn't have that affordability built in. And so it really made me appreciate it from that aspect. And then, you know, I really in high school fell in love with science, and I thought this would be a really fun thing to do. And I decided, like many kids, do I want to be a doctor? And a lot of times, and as a young person, you don't really know what that means and what that entails. And the personal sacrifices that go into looking after other people, sometimes at the expense of yourself and your family and everything that goes with that. But that to me, once I headed on that scientific and medical path, it was really kind of no turning back from that. And it's allowed me to serve some of the underserved. And that's part of the reason why I gravitated towards the cancer patients, is I identified a lot of patients that didn't have access to care until very late in their disease process. And I really felt like I could relate to them and help them in an empathetic way.
That's interesting. So two artist parents, is that what I understood?
That's right.
Very creative, yep. Creative parents and who nurtured and brought up a scientist. That's very interesting. Yeah. That's interesting. You'll have to write a book about that, I would think.
Yeah. It's funny because, you know, the we're all hands-on. We all do things with our hands, but I do with my hands is very different. And I kind of went into it in many ways to rebel. You know, you don't want to do what your parents are doing. You want to do something diametrically opposite. And it's funny because the most important thing that serves me as a scientist is my creativity, which I got from my parents, because if I wasn't thinking of innovative ways to do things, I wouldn't make it as a scientist. So it's kind of funny how, you know, as you grow, you learn to appreciate your upbringing and what you gain from that.
Yes. In fact, that's why they've put the A in STEAM, you know, instead of just STEM, science, technology, engineering, yeah, and math, it's now STEAM. And for that very purpose, it's so important to be a creative problem solver or to access that part of your brain that's helping you, obviously, to be very successful at what you do. In fact, I know that in some science programs, they require literature courses to help.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, to help with that critical thinking and creativity and to bring that into their work. Well, so what have you had to overcome, if anything, to be as successful as you have been in a field perhaps where you've been the minority? And I'm just guessing that.
Yeah, and that is very true. I think surgeons and certainly oncologic surgeons are primarily men. And so that's been, and scientists as well, has really been dominated by that. The medical school graduation classes now are turning out about even split of men and women. But when I first started doing this, I was the only senior resident in my class. I was the only one of a small minority of women going to head and neck surgery when we all applied for our fellowships in that. So, and then to add the science part on top of that, I was just at a meeting in Chicago last week presenting some of our work, and I was the only woman who spoke about that from a scientific perspective in that group. And so I feel, you know, one of our collaborators here at Winship recently called me a unicorn, and sometimes I do feel like one, which is good and bad. It's nice to have set myself apart, but at the same time, it has been difficult to find mentors that have the same struggles. And particularly, again, growing up in a family with nobody that's really in science and nobody that's even really had that access to higher education. How did you surround yourself with the right mentors to kind of show you the path, if you will? And so that early on, I think, was a challenge. And now that I feel sort of established in my career and really making my way, that's less of an issue. And it's now what I find is in the early to mid-career stage, we as women are not as good about asking for what we need and promoting ourselves, you know, versus men. And I'm not just gender profiling here. There are good data to support that. Is we as women need to be more outgoing and saying, I want to be on this academic committee. I want to be on that task force. I want to work on this with somebody together. And I find that I'm trying to work on that because that's something that doesn't come naturally to me, but it's something that needs to be done.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's so much research that's been done about women's confidence levels versus men and just stepping up and asking for what you need or for what you want. Yep. So yeah, you're absolutely spot on. It's obvious that you have been successful regardless of the challenges. What's your proudest achievement so far?
Probably, I would say there are a few things and that have come from perseverance and really kind of pulling together all those things I talked about earlier and matching my clinical career with my research career and my clinical trial career. Probably what I'm most proud of at this point was the first new treatment for head and neck cancer that I took from bench to bedside. It's a class of drugs that works really well to enhance the effects of radiation in head and neck cancer patients. Traditionally, we've used chemotherapy, which has a ton of side effects, and it's kind of got a bad rap for that reason. In head and neck cancer, we use chemotherapy to enhance the effects of radiation in patients with more aggressive disease in hopes of increasing their chance of cure. So I started studying a drug about 7 years ago in my lab, and I paired it with radiation and mouse models and other lab experiments, and we found that it was working. And it took us really about 5 years to get enough data and get enough evidence that this was worth studying in humans. And then it really was challenged and to write a clinical trial and figure out how to now move from curing mice to curing patients with that drug combination of radiation and this new drug. And we just opened up our clinical trial after years of looking for funding and working out the logistics and all the regulatory aspects of that. I opened that trial and enrolled and completed treatment our first patient within the last few months. And so that for me was 7 years in the making, and finally to see something get to that path where a patient has now less side effects to deal with for the rest of his life because we used a novel drug that we first started studying on a hunch 7 years ago. So that's really makes it all worth it.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
So does that mean then that you'll be able to, once the clinical trial is completed and has proven to be successful, would that mean then less chemo to follow radiation because the effectiveness of radiation has increased?
Absolutely. Oh, wow. So that's our hope, is to get rid of the chemo, use radiation with a drug that's better tolerated. And my hope is that after this trial is done, we'll be able to branch out nationally, do a bigger trial and change the way we treat these patients, which will be a huge win.
Wow. Wow. This is so exciting. I can understand why you're in the field that you're in. Well, so I know that as a surgeon, when you're in the OR, that you have to act as a leader, right? That you have mm-hmm. your extended team there and that you have to bring them all together. And you're a leader outside of the OR, let's face it, you've earned that right. So in our definition, we always say leaders inspire others into effective action to achieve a set of shared goals. So how do you see yourself as a leader, and how do you inspire others to reach whatever common goal you may have?
That's a good question. That's something that I'm actually really in the process of learning that. It's something that we don't get training for. In medicine, you know, we get training to do the hands-on tasks, to order the right tests, to diagnose the patient and do all these things. And what we really don't get is leadership training. And a lot of us in science, we start our own labs and we have to realize what happens when people in our labs don't get along with each other or when there's conflict and how to deal with all that. And the difference in academia versus industry is I think industry, they're a lot better in recognizing how important that is to get that kind of training. So if anything, I've had to sort of learn in doing. And I think that, you know, I sort of learned a lot over the years from being a chief resident and to being a fellow and now to being on faculty for the last 7 years and change, how to do that. And I basically have learned by doing. But now I think that the next thing to do is to try to help other junior faculty and other colleagues that we've had who have started more recently not make the same mistakes that I've made. And so that I think is where I feel I am most a leader, is to try to talk to other newer surgeon and scientist faculty in terms of, you know, how to manage those conflicts and how to minimize them from happening in the first place, so that we can, like I said, all achieve a common goal. In the operating room, all personalities have to be cast aside, and the physicians and the nurses and the anesthesiologists, we have to all work together to achieve the common goal of getting the patient through a safe and effective surgery. And same thing goes in the lab. We all have to work together to discover something new and look at its values. So you're absolutely right that it's sort of, we have to learn by doing. I just wish we had better training up front, and I'm trying to do my part to do that earlier for others.
Well, TurkNet is happy to help.
But let me take you up on that.
But I can only imagine coming out of the airline industry as I did, where the captain, similar to the surgeon in charge, the captain is often held up on a pedestal, and everybody bows to the, in a traditional old sense. Now, that's no longer the case. We've learned along the way that it's a team effort. So
Absolutely. That's
why I brought this subject up, because I can imagine in the OR, traditionally, not so much anymore, you know, the surgeon has been seen as being the godlike figure that everyone bows to, but that's not always the case, I would think. Hopefully not anymore, because you need your extended team. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's what you're describing.
That's a really good, I think that's a really good point. And I think that in many ways, we as women may be, if anything, maybe a little bit more empathetic to that exact fact. And a lot of us, you know, have spent time and had family members in nursing, and I worked as a surgical tech back in college. And so I think you're absolutely right that it's more effective to really treat everybody as a part of the team and not to, you know, set egos aside and be compassionate with the team members. And I feel like, you know, by getting along with everybody in the operating room, no matter what their role, people are more excited to go quickly and get what you need in a pinch when things get a little stressful. And I feel like it's a much more effective, people are much more happy to stay late and work with me in my OR than some of the surgeons that may be a little bit more curt and a little bit more, like you said, in the traditional personality, the way it used to be. And I'm delighted to see that is changing as we go forward. And a lot of people have realized exactly what you said about leadership style.
Yeah, what seemingly you've described is that you've earned their commitment.
Absolutely.
If you have people that are willing to go above and beyond, then you know that you've earned their commitment. Well, so what's your vision for yourself? What's next?
Well, basically, I have to say that I'm in a situation where I sort of have my dream job, and I'm doing, you know, splitting my time among those three things that I do. And I think I see the vision as sort of a consistent pipeline of you know, in a circle of, you know, thinking of something during patient care, bringing it to the lab, bringing that to clinical trials and back to the clinic. And I'm just breaking into that zone, really, with the clinical trial I told you about and one other one that we've started. So in the future, I see that circle being more robust and more consistent, and, you know, being more of a mentor and a leader for others as I kind of get established myself. And I really think that, you know, giving back is the way to go. Interesting story is that I started doing research in the lab as a high school student. And I went to the local university and spent a summer. And for me, that was the beginning of my love for research. And ultimately, this summer, I was asked at Winship to host a high school student in my lab to have that similar experience doing cancer research. And we did. And it was a lot of fun to kind of realize where I started out with that same sense of wonder. And it was a real treat to be able to give back. So I see myself doing more of that as my stress load goes down and as my lab gets more established and that circle gets to be more robust.
So giving forward as well as giving back, but helping young
people. Yep.
That's fantastic. And related to that, I wanted to ask you, how do you advise other young women who may be inspired by you and your success, who may be listening in, or who may be mothers of daughters who want to inspire them? What advice would you give them?
Well, I think a lot of it would be related to sort of what we were talking about earlier. As women, we really need to boost each other up and build each other's confidence and ask for what we need. And that's really, you know, I just started within a new mentoring program at Winship, where there's another junior faculty member who's also a scientist and a clinician. And again, I've given this a lot of thought about what my advice for her will be. And a lot of it comes down to ask for what you need early, because I didn't do that early. In the beginning of your career, you count on your well-known mentors. When you're fresh in their mind, they think of you and they throw your name in the hat. It's not just mentorship, it's sponsorship for opportunities and lectures and things like this. And ultimately, as you get further away from their thoughts and branch out on your own, you may be left in limbo if you don't sort of ask for what you need and continue to reach out to people if you're not fresh in their mind. And so that's actually been published and called the invisible mid-career female surgeon. So in many ways that can happen. And my advice would be to try to fight back against that. And we as women need to not cut each other down, but really to build each other up and support and mentor and sponsor each other. And so I think that's critical to latch on to mentors who can do that. And the mentors in my career have not necessarily been women. A lot of them have been men that just knew the science that I wanted to learn at any given moment. But I think I've gotten excellent mentorship from all. So
what I'm hearing you say is also to keep that network alive.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yes. Stay in touch. Well, Nikki, this has been amazing. Thank you so much. So many insights about how you grew up, the evolution of your process of becoming a physician, and how to do that. It's going to serve as a lot of inspiration. So thank you so much. Appreciate you.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Take care.